You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, January the 28th. I'm Joy Cardine, and we are very pleased to have with us, just for the next few minutes, the governor of the state of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, to talk about where he sees common ground with President Obama following the State of the Union and the president's visit to Wisconsin. And we'll see if we can get the governor to give us a little preview of his State of the State address, which is scheduled for this coming Tuesday. Governor Walker joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good to be with you.
Thanks a lot. You met with President Obama at the Green Bay Airport on Wednesday, and you greeted him with a Green Bay Packers jersey with the name Obama and the number one emblazoned on it. How did he react to that?
He was very a good sport about it, very gracious about it. The president hosted myself and all the new governors at the out in D.C. at the Boyer House for a luncheon back in December, and he spent a little time socializing with each of us. He talked obviously policy during the lunch, but had a little fun with each of us. And he and I spent the majority of our time talking about the Bear-Packer game coming up at the end of the season. So, of course, when he walked down the steps off of Air Force One, he saw what I had in my hand even before I unfolded it. And he said, "I should have known, Walker, you were going to rub it in." had some fun with it. He said he got that. He got a jersey from my friend Mayor Jim Schmidt, who was with me Mayor of Green Bay, and then later we went to Manitowoc to Orion Energy Systems. The mayor there as well gave him a jersey. So in about an hour's time, he got three Packer jerseys, and he said he knew he was going to have to eat a little crow after being a Bears fan last Sunday.
Did he see the error in his ways in going with the Bears and pick the Pack to win the Super Bowl?
Well, my only skeleton in my closet is my mother's a Cubs fan, and I laugh because she always says, "Wait till next year." Well, he said about the same thing. We'll get you next year, but he just said congratulations. I don't think we made a Packer fan out of him yet, but he acknowledged that at least for that day, the better team will.
Well, anyway, I know you have no doubts as to who will win the Super Bowl. Will you be betting with Pennsylvania's governor the same way you bet with Illinois' governor?
You know, we've been on our Twitter site. It's kind of fun, @GovWalker. We've been taking suggestions all this week, just like we did the week leading up to the Bears game. And it's been kind of interesting. You know, that, for example, flying the flag of the winning team over the losing team's capital was an idea we picked off, a suggestion off of Twitter. And the food bank we haven't collected on yet. Hopefully in the next week or so we'll work out the right time for Governor Quinn to come up. But we're taking similar suggestions. Obviously, we like to do some fun. I know Governor Colbert over in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and I'd like to be able to collect on that bet, too. Because my guess is, my score, at least my prediction, is 28-24 Packers.
28-24. You know, I didn't mean to spend our whole time talking football, but is the Packers' appearance in the Super Bowl and presumably winning the Super Bowl good for business for the state of Wisconsin?
Oh, there's no doubt. Just morale overall. I was kidding at the at Orion Energy, which, by the way, I thought was great. People wondered why a Republican was at a Democrat president's event, and I said, one, he's the president, and I respect that, and two, you know, he's the fact that he's highlighting a Wisconsin business that is growing and as outstanding as Orion. It really shows that Wisconsin's open for business, and in the same way you asked about the Packers, the excitement, you know, we laughed last Tuesday when we saw the State of the Union, but it's kind of interesting, I guess, that the State of the Union address, you had people changing the seating charts to have Republicans and Democrats together. Before the president came in on Wednesday, when I was waiting before his comments, I was talking with State Senator Mark Miller and State Senator John Erpenbach, obviously two Democrats from the Madison area, and I said, in our case, we don't need to have a seating chart to be united. All we need are the green and gold, the Packers. And that, I think, in a way, even in the Capitol, has been helpful. I mean, we're having fun with that. We even did, per Senator Hansen's suggestion from Green Bay, we're going to start next week illuminating the Capitol in green and gold. All those things create a distraction, maybe, in a way, from the economic and fiscal challenges we face in the state. And I think there's a lot of good buzz out there. A lot of life in business and otherwise is focused on momentum, and having something that unites us as a state is a great thing.
Well, let's get back to the president's visit to Manitowoc, where I know you were with him at Orion. And I wonder if you... You agree with the president that our government should invest in education, technology, and renewable energy to create more jobs.
Well, I think I looked that day. It was interesting. I was asked afterwards, the press came over, and I get a kick out of it because sometimes, you know, I read editorials and certain editorial pages kind of rub their hands in the fact that there's too much partisanship, too much division. And so I go to talk to the press, and the first thing they ask is about questions of division. And I said my purpose in being there, besides respecting the office, was to hone in on the things I agree on. So in my case, I look at the fact that the federal government's approaching a $1.5 trillion deficit, and that the president on Tuesday night said, and he repeated it again since then, that he wants to put controls on the discretionary, much of the discretionary spending outside of defense. He wants to, slow the rate of growth in other areas. He wants to try and get a handle on the federal deficit. I think that's a good thing, not only for Wisconsin, but for the country. But where I particularly agree with the president is on his push saying he's not going to sign any legislation filled with earmarks. Now, that's not only an important issue for us as Americans because of all the pork and excess it's put in legislation. It's something, at least in Wisconsin, for years, former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold, as well as current U.S. Representative Paul Ryan, have been pushing for that sort of reform. It is a good thing just for the country, but it's particularly good for Wisconsin because in an earmarks race, California, New York, big congressional delegations always has the upper hand. If we're in a system where we compete based on merit, based on need, based on real data, not just the power, the size of someone's congressional delegation, we're always going to fare better in Wisconsin. So when I looked at things like that and heard those things in the President's State of the Union address, I say those are things I'm ready to stand with the president on, to support him on, to give him backing on. And when he talks about controlling spending, the only thing I ask in return, and I think other governors do of both political parties, is give the states, give the governors more flexibility. If you're going to freeze those funds, if you're not going to increase them, then at least give us greater autonomy for us and our state legislatures to be able to control and really on a state-by-state basis put the dollars where there's the greatest need.
Well, we promised to let you go now, Governor Walker, but before you go, can you give us just a little hint of your State of the State message coming up next week?
Well, in our case, in many ways, in fact, originally scheduled for the 25th, per the president's call for the State of the Union, we pushed it back a week. But in many ways, it's going to be similar. We're going to, I pointed out, in much the same way the president, for that matter, Paul Ryan, did as well, we're going to be realistic about the challenges we face, which I think are real both on a fiscal and on an economic basis. But we're also going to be optimistic about our solutions. You can't have one without the other. And too many times in politics these days, we have people either down on the challenges we face with no solutions or unrealistic about the challenges we face and in turn not realistic about the solutions. We're going to lay out a clear path as the challenges we face when it comes to the state's economy, the job loss that we have, and the fiscal challenges, the $3 billion we face in this next budget. But then in turn, we're going to lay out some very specific solutions as to how we can get Wisconsin working again, both when it comes to jobs and when it comes to our budget.
Well, we will be listening to what you have to say next Tuesday night at 7, right?
That's exactly right.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy. Bye now.
Governor Scott Walker, we will be broadcasting live Governor Walker's State of the State address on Tuesday, February the 1st at 7 p.m. on Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. And the next day, on that next Wednesday, we will follow up with many different guests from many different viewpoints, assessing and reacting to and analyzing the state of the state of Wisconsin. Coming up, we will be talking with the author of the book, The Panic Virus, about how skeptics and dubious medical researchers and the media contributed to some massive misunderstanding and fear when it came to a link, which turned out to be a false claim, that vaccines cause autism. We will welcome your thoughts and questions about the panic virus at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, January the 28th. And we welcome now our next guest. He is the author of the book, The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him. This book is outlines how dubious or unethical medical researchers, skeptics, and the media can all get together and contribute to massive misunderstanding and fear. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. He is Seth Mnookin, who is contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a former senior writer for Newsweek. He is the author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. And he joins us in the studio. He is in Madison. He was speaking yesterday at the Health Sciences Library on the UW-Madison campus about his book, and we're happy to have him with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So what is the panic virus?
Well, the book, the sort of narrative through line of the book deals with a series of scares relating to vaccines and a claimed connection to autism and other developmental disorders. And these concerns started about 13 years ago in 1998 with a study that posited a potential link between the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and gut disorders, and then gut disorders and autism. And that then really permeated a lot of Western Europe and the U.S. And merged eventually with some other concerns about mercury-based preservative. And so now, despite over a decade's worth of research indicating that there is no connection, this has remained a big issue. Vaccine rates have dropped, and what we've started to see over the last several years is an increase in some of the vaccine-preventable infectious diseases that we really thought were in the rearview mirror.
Indeed, this research showing a supposed link between vaccines and autism was thoroughly debunked just within the last couple of weeks?
Well, actually, yeah. Most recently, there was a series of reports that ran in the British Medical Journal that accused the initial researcher, someone named Andrew Wakefield, of outright fraud. But the actual work had been debunked. He had lost his medical license. The paper that he had initially written had been retracted. His co-authors had disavowed it. So the work itself had been disproven for a while. This was sort of the latest accusation about his personal conduct.
You also blame the media for talking about his research?
Well, not so much talking about it, but presenting it from the outset in a sort of on the one hand, on the other hand, in that type of framework, when that framework wasn't really appropriate here. I think that what you see a lot is under a claim of objectivity, you have stories presented in a way that actually don't do the facts justice. An example I use in the book, another example is the birther movement, where you had media outlets saying this group of people claims that President Obama was not born in the United States, and this group of people, including the president himself, claims that he is. And in fact, I don't think that's a he says, she says type of situation. I think that should be, the story is he was actually born in the U.S. He's a U.S. citizen. And this unspooled a little bit in that same way. There was never research that was reliable that indicated a potential link. Even the initial studies in 1998 were so limited that there was not, had they been accurate, there weren't any real conclusions that could be drawn. So I think it was an example of the media sort of jumping onto a controversial story, a scare story, and then once that gets out into a population, it's very difficult to unscare people.
Yeah. And you also have sometimes very well-known people believing the story, and when you have a celebrity or someone else who's quite well known saying vaccines cause autism, that furthers the fire?
Well, definitely. I mean, I think our culture gives a lot of time and attention and oxygen to celebrities. And so, for instance, you had Jenny McCarthy, former television star and model, who very publicly claimed that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had either caused or contributed to her son's autism. She wrote a series of books about this and was given an enormous amount of airtime, very prominently on the Oprah Winfrey Show, on Larry King's show. She was given excerpts from the book in People magazine. So it was a series of very credulous accounts that then only furthered this sort of myth taking root in people's minds. And I think the fact that she's well spoken and smart and famous and good looking certainly contributed to the quickness with which people wanted to put her on air.
Yeah. Why did you want to write about this issue?
Well, I started working on it over 3 years ago, and it was before I had children, before I was an expectant father, and it was something that I just noticed was coming up a lot in conversation, this concern about vaccines. And what struck me was that my friends, who I was used to having conversations with about the importance of scientific research, relating to climate change, relating to evolution and how we need to have faith in the facts, seemed to not apply to this debate. At the time, I didn't know which side the evidence supported, but I was struck by the fact that when my friends said, I am choosing to vaccinate or I'm choosing to space them out, they would say that this was based on gut instinct or on intuition and not on sort of a careful examination of the facts. And for such a basic issue involving health and their lives and their children's lives, that was something that really struck me. And so that was what started me on this.
Yeah. We have a Facebook comment from a listener named Jennifer. Seems like our society has gotten to the point where we don't want to do anything or be responsible. Just give us the information, right or wrong. We'll be happy to make an uninformed decision. Yikes, this is getting scary. She did go on, though, to say that she's very skeptical of medical research or scientific research, depending on who funds it. And it's hard for her to know what's true and what's not.
Sure. And I think that's very understandable. There's been a lot of revelations over the past several years about drug company funded studies, studies where the author has turned out either not to have done the research or it's been presented in someone else's name. Fortunately, in this case, we don't need to rely on the drug companies say so that these vaccines are safe, because this is likely the most studied childhood public health initiative over the past 20 years. So we can look to data compiled by governments around the world, independent researchers, as well as studies that have been done by the drug companies. But I definitely understand and share that skepticism about big business, about big pharmaceutical companies. I obviously think that there has to be some point at which you do decide, okay, well, there are enough of these different institutions and government entities and researchers that are all saying the same thing, that are unanimous about this, and I need to decide that that's what I'm gonna go with.
Yeah, I have to admit that we have been contacted via email or otherwise from from very, very intelligent and well-meaning people, people who have scientific backgrounds, even who work at the University of Wisconsin, who have children who they believe have autism because of a vaccine, and they have wanted us to do stories on this or talk shows on this. So, what's a talk show host to do?
Well, I think. You know, that was one of the things that I did not, I hadn't anticipated would be a part of the book and really became one of the most fascinating parts to me. And that was looking at the reasons and the ways in which we create narratives for our own lives. There is obviously a correlation in time between the period in which children are given vaccines, usually under age three, and the period in which children are diagnosed with developmental disorders. So there are going to be a lot of cases in which the two come up at the same time. What I found so interesting is that, or one of the things I found so interesting is that when there were contemporaneous medical records or video of children whose parents knew what had happened to their children in terms of they got a vaccine and then this their behavior changed, it oftentimes turned out that their memories did not entirely coincide with what the evidence showed. Not because they are being anything but 100% honest, but because that's how the human brain works. We reform things so that they make more sense, so that they can create a good story for us.
We'll continue talking with our guest, the author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine and Fear, talking about how when dubious research and an eager media get together, they can spread unwarranted fear and do more harm than good. Specifically, the link, the now proven false link between vaccines and autism. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you would like to join in. You can also comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll check news and then we'll be back. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It is 7:36 on this Friday, January the 28th. Dishonest medical researchers have taken advantage of desperate parents across the country with such claims as a vaccine autism link. That's according to our guest this hour, who says the media are also at fault for fueling the controversy and treating all points of view as equally valid. Our guest is Seth Mnookin, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a former senior writer for Newsweek. He is the author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. He is in Wisconsin. He is in Madison this morning. He spoke last night on the UW-Madison campus on the at the Health Sciences Library. And we have many callers, Seth, who have thoughts or questions on this. So let me go right to the phones. Laura in Madison. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I guess I'm having a lot of trouble lately. I mean, I'm talking like in the last decade or two. We have so many contaminants, let's call them, in our environment that have been talked about. Everything from antiperspirants to Teflon pans to bisphenol A. And yet we don't have any very good studies to really talk about how toxic these things really are. In fact, toxicity is something that's very poorly understood by the general population. And you combine that with the ability we have with such exquisite instrumentation that we have available to us these days to detect incredibly minute traces of these things. It makes people very, very confused and panic driven. One thing I'll bring up that's been a problem here in Madison is hexavalent chromium. We have a standard that's being developed out in California of 6/100ths of a part per billion, which if it's like beyond most people's comprehension. As to how tiny an amount that is. And yet we're having people who are as you say, panic-driven about these things. Mm-hmm. What do we do?
I think there are a number of really, really good points there. And one is the number of contaminants that there are in the environment. And I think this is your point. And I hope I'm not misrepresenting it. But when you hear about all of that outside of any context, it can be very, very difficult to know what you're supposed to do with that information. You know, there's aluminum and antiperspirant. And then, you know, someone says, well, what that does is seal off your tissue and it causes a buildup. And then that can increase the possibility that you have Alzheimer's. There are lots of theories that make a certain amount of intuitive sense. I think that we actually do know more about the toxicity of specific substances. There are cases in which we don't necessarily know the cumulative effect, but talking specifically about vaccines, one of the things, now that the mercury-based preservative has been removed, one of the things that has been raised recently is that there's aluminum in vaccines, in some vaccines, which again sounds very, very frightening. And it's a good example of what happens to information when it's unmoored from context, because the amount of aluminum in vaccines is half of the amount, actually less than half of the amount of aluminum that an infant receives in breast milk. If the infant's taking formula, it's one-tenth of the amount. So there are many of what we think of as toxic chemicals are naturally present in the environment, and we get them to some extent or another every day. When it's presented to us without a frame of understanding, it can sound much scarier than it is or should be.
The chromium example, it was an environmental group that published a list of cities in the U.S. that had this chromium in their water, and Madison was near the top of the list. And people who live here were very concerned. Our water utility people said, in essence, don't worry about it.
Right. Right.
That's not good enough.
Well, I don't know anything mm-hmm. about that specific issue. I definitely agree that the answer, don't worry about it, is not good enough. And one thing the caller mentioned is giving context. You know, if it's doubled, has it doubled from mm-hmm. one part per 100 billion to two parts per 100 billion? Or has it doubled from one part per 100 to mm-hmm. two parts per 100? It's a very different thing. And I think what we run into a lot, and what one of the topics I get into in my book, is the inability that the media and the public health community has had in finding a way to clearly and accurately communicate science to the public. There are a number of different reasons for that, but I think that becomes and is becoming more and more and more of an issue, especially because we can go online and find information and look at it without context. And that is one of the things that can be very scary.
Thank you very much, Laura. Since we have so many other callers, let me move on to Eric in Madison next. Hello, Eric.
Good morning, Seth and Joy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I pretty much agree with the MMR vaccines and so on. And I probably picked up SV40 when I was 4 years old in 1962.
What is SV40?
Simian virus 40. Seth knows about that. But my main point, a few years back, I heard Dr. Gerberding at NIH hold a public news conference about how the bird flu is going to be a worldwide pandemic, and oh my gosh, we should all be scared. And I'm just wondering, Seth, was that grandstanding, and how much of that went to build NIH's budget? I'll take my answer off the air.
It's a very good question, and I think a lot of people had a lot of concerns about the both the swine flu and the bird flu situations, and there was a lot of fear that the WHO was building up the concern. I think that was a very difficult situation because it was the type of scenario in which it's really paramount on public health officials to prepare for a worst case scenario. And there was concern that that was a similar strain of flu that had caused hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of deaths worldwide, early in the 20th century. I do think that that was most definitely another example in which there was very poor communication, poor risk communication. And instead of people saying, instead of officials saying to the public, these are exactly what our concerns are. These are what we've done in order to try and ensure that the vaccine that we're preparing is safe. This is why we hope that you choose to get vaccinated. Instead, there was a sort of all or nothing quality to a lot of the information that came out. And I think, you know, people like you, a lot of people want and deserve to have a more clear explanation of exactly what it is going on. And I think if the public health community, not just in this, not just in the United States, but really across Western Europe and in Australia, wants to be able to continue to move forward with population-wide public health efforts, there really needs to be a rethinking about the type of communication and the degree of communication that there is with the public, and a recognition that that's a two-way street.
Seth, why did we remove this mercury-based preservative from vaccines, which many thought was a part of this link with autism, if it wasn't a problem?
That's a great question, mm-hmm. And I think it illustrates one of the reasons why people are skeptical of vaccine manufacturers and the government. Without getting too bogged down in the backstory, in the late 90s, there were a series of environmental initiatives that required the government to tally up the amount of mercury that was present in the environment and foods. And it was really the first time that the NIH and drug manufacturers tallied up the total amount of an ethyl mercury-based preservative that was used in vaccines. They knew how much was in individual vaccines, but they hadn't totaled it up. And when they totaled it up, that amount was larger than the recommended levels, limits, for methyl mercury, a different type of mercury. That when you say ethyl mercury versus methyl mercury, it sounds essentially like no difference. You know, I would compare it to ethyl alcohol versus methyl alcohol. One kills you and one gets you drunk. You know, a single letter can have a big difference. Mm-hmm. What happened then in 1999 was the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended removing thimerosal under a just out of caution while these studies could be undertaken. It was removed. People don't need to worry about there being thimerosal in vaccines now. There were then studies on millions of children, which thankfully showed that there was not any connection between developmental disabilities and thimerosal. But I think that was a very clear example of where the vaccine manufacturers and the government fell down on the job and did not do what they should have been doing all along. I think that's a very shameful chapter in the national story of vaccine intervention.
Seth Manukin is our guest. He is the author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. We will take more of your calls for him in just a moment. Let me check the weather forecast for today. There is a winter weather advisory in effect for mainly the northeast half of Wisconsin from this afternoon through this evening. 2 to 4 inches of snow possible in the northeast half of Wisconsin. There is a chance of light snow in far southern and southwest Wisconsin, maybe even some freezing drizzle in far southwest Wisconsin. Highs today, mid-20s to low 30s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 11 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Friday, January the 28th. Coming up after 8, it's our Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different political perspectives talking with you about the news of the week, including the State of the Union and President Obama's visit to Wisconsin this week, and much more in our Week in Review coming up after 8 o'clock. Back now to the phones for Seth Mnookin, who is the author of The Panic Virus. And our next caller is Terry in Menominee. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks for having this program. This is a very important topic. And I agree that Dr. Wakefield's study was junk science, fabricated, and I believe that autism is not caused by vaccines. However, that said, using the word autism is like using the word cancer. There are many different types of autism, many types of cancers, and there's going to be different etiologies for different types of autism. There's different phenotypes and genotypes. There are some children who have predispositions to inborn errors of metabolism or mitochondrial diseases, and when they experience a fever or some other kind of catabolic stress, serious illness, they can experience neurodevelopmental regression. So my question is, isn't it possible that if a child had one of these conditions and developed a high fever, possibly seizures after a vaccine, could that put them into some kind of neurodevelopmental regression? Mm-hmm. I believe it can. I believe it's happened, and it has been in the literature. There's a paper authored by Dr. John Poling and Dr. John Schaffner.
I want to cut in for 1 second, because the Poling paper is a paper that actually the editor of the journal that appeared in, when he found out later that John Poling, the lead author, was actually the claimant in a suit against vaccine manufacturers or in vaccine court about exactly the issue he was writing about, he said that the entire incident was, quote, appalling. And said that there's no substitution for honesty in terms of clearly stating conflicts of interest. So I would very much caution against using that single paper, which was actually based just solely on his daughter, although he did not say that in the paper, as a foundation for your thinking on one thing or another. The larger point that autism, quote, can't really be defined as one thing, and that we don't have any clear understanding of the causes or possible triggers of autism or Asperger's syndrome or developmental disorders is very true. I think the trap or the danger of saying isn't it possible is that the answer is always yes. Isn't it possible that we will discover tomorrow that human beings can fly? It is possible. It's also incredibly unlikely. So it is possible that we will find that somehow, despite the millions and millions of children that have been studied, that vaccines are directly triggering autism. It is extremely unlikely. And when you start to define that in more and more and more specific ways, a subset of children who are genetically susceptible because of a mitochondrial disorder to getting a fever that then causes neurodevelopmental regression, you start to talk about things that are untestable, because you can eventually describe such a small portion of the population, or one child, that there's no way to show conclusively that that's not the case, which ends up sounding very scary, but again, is not how you do you go about conducting science.
Terry, thank you for the call. Very, very briefly, because we have other callers. What was the dubious or the conflict of interest that this particular researcher had?
His daughter, Hannah Poling, was the claimant in a suit asking for compensation due to what was supposed to be a vaccine-induced illness for millions of dollars. So the Pollin family actually was in something that's called, quote, vaccine court, and this was not this was not disclosed in the article or even to some of his co-authors.
Yeah, and your point, part of your point, is that members of the media don't know all of this and report on these things, and the public gets fearful.
Right, and in fact, in that case, the editor of the journal didn't know, and that doesn't, by definition, mean that his results were wrong. I think it does mean definitely that they should be interpreted in a different light. And regardless, you don't look at a study of one child and draw conclusions, widespread conclusions from that.
Don in New Richmond emails, there was a time when medical science told us that bloodletting was good, and then that mass childhood tonsillectomies were necessary and total hysterectomies were a normal thing. We learned better ideas than these as time went by. Is it possible that time will teach us that our concerns about mandatory childhood vaccinations were not unfounded?
I think it's a little bit of a red herring to point to previous instances in which medical interventions clearly ended up not being accurate. It's a little bit like saying, you know, we had slavery once. Does that mean you can't trust anything that the government does? What we do know is that vaccines are effective and that vaccine preventable diseases are fatal. Last year alone, in 2010, 10 children died of whooping cough in California. 9 of those kids were under 6 months old. That is an absolute tragedy. We've had measles outbreaks in this country because of pockets of under-vaccinated children. One outbreak cost $10 million to contain, resulted in the hospitalization of a child. I spoke to parents who lost their children to vaccine-preventable diseases. So we know beyond any doubt that measles and Hib and whooping cough are potentially fatal, and that vaccines are an effective way of protecting against them. So is it possible that one day we will come up with a different way to combat these diseases, or will eradicate them, as is the case with smallpox? Maybe. For the time being, this is the best and a very safe way to protect ourselves.
Try to fit one more in. Debbie and Madison, we're almost out of time, Debbie.
Real quick, I just wanted to know if you've ever heard of the Dr. Sears vaccine schedule and
Yes.
what your thoughts are on that.
Yes. Dr. Sears is a California pediatrician who wrote something called the Vaccine Book, in which he puts forth several alternative vaccine schedules. I have a real problem with Bob Sears. He doesn't have any training in vaccinology or immunology. It was, in fact, his patient that caused that recent measles outbreak that cost $10 million to contain. One of the things that he recommends in his book is, if you are concerned about, for instance, the MMR vaccine, and you choose not to vaccinate your child, don't tell your neighbors, so that you can be relatively secure that measles will not come into that area because everyone around you will be vaccinated. I think that's a morally indefensible position, to say that if you are concerned that something's going to injure your child, don't tell the people around you and just hope that they get that intervention. Mm-hmm. So I have a real problem with Bob Sears and would not use his book to dictate what I do with my child.
Only 30 seconds to go. If someone remembers just one thing from this conversation or from your book, what do you want it to be?
I think what we should remember is the importance of good information and of holding our journalists and our public health officials to high standards in terms of how they communicate information.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Seth Mnookin, author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. He spoke last night on the UW-Madison campus. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, to Bill Martins, to Rob Ferret, and to Chris Molina for producing these programs. And thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.